to be fair, if you saw me like half an hour ago, it was definitely not a pretty sight. Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Great Things with Great Tech, the podcast highlighting companies doing great things with great technology. My name's Anthony Spiteri, and in this episode, we're talking to a company that from its inception has believed in the undeniable future of Ceph as the premier platform for software-defined storage, and went so far as to custom design and build a dedicated storage appliance that is optimized for Ceph. That company is Softiron, and I'm talking to Phil Straw, CEO and co-founder of Softiron. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Excellent. So just before we get into software-defined storage, Ceph, and all sorts of goodness around that, just want to shout out again, if you like great things with great tech and would like to feature on future episodes, you can click the link in the show notes or go to launch.gtwgt.com and register your interest. As a reminder, all episodes of GTWGT are available on all good podcasting platforms. So we're talking about Google, Apple, Spotify, all hosted and distributed by Anchor FM. And that'll keep you up to date with all future and, more importantly, all past episodes. So with that, Phil, let's get into Softiron and talk a little bit about the company, history and facts, and, you know, a company that you co-founded back in 2012 in London. So maybe just talk a little bit, maybe a bit of your background, and then go into, you know, how you decided to establish Softiron.
My background is really, kind of engineering, computing science and electronics. Worked in networking and computer security for the beginning of my career, and then moved to Silicon Valley to join this thing called the startup about 23 years ago, and then did a number of startups along the way, almost exclusively with a few chapters in larger companies, just to remind myself why I love startups so much. And that's been all over the map. So, you know, pure software, automotive, security, and then crazy things like underwater scuba diving electronics and special forces equipment.
Okay.
It's all over the map. And then, we have quite a gathered tribe now through those chapters of lots of people that have worked together, and that's sort of the kernel of how we started Softiron. It's a bunch of people that have worked together in some cases 25 years.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess that's what I'm learning as I'm sort of, you know, more and more plugged into that world, is that you do pick up those people that you like to work with and that become not only, you know, workmates and trusted partners, but also friends as well. And, you know, a lot of companies that I've spoken to on the show have that, where they've, you know, started somewhere, they've continued on a journey together, and then they've created something special, you know, at the end of it. So talk a little bit about, you know, why you decided to start Softiron as a company, and maybe as well just explain what you guys do, just, you know, in that sort of same vein.
Well, I think we probably started Softiron because, I had a few hairs left, in my journey of lots of startups. And we were frustrated by the state of the industry. So there's a couple of things going on sort of meta level. One, you know, kind of manufacturing has sort of mostly left the United States and gone to Asia. We kind of exported that low margin business out. And I think with a few exceptions, like people say like Apple, they use manufacturing as a weapon of war. We thought that in the data center, there was an ability to do that. And the ability to design something specific versus generic. When we look, there's just a lot of fat, and super demonstrable what happens when you remove that fat and you do something very specific, something very task focused. And so what we set on a journey to do is actually not just tackle storage, but tackle the data center as a whole. That's kind of our bigger ambition, and started with storage because that was really the kind of hard problem. And in the early days of the company, we did lots of different things around ecosystem development for ARM64 in general, which was just coincidence around market timing, the introduction of 64-bit ARM.
Okay, yeah, because I think that's in your timeline, it was about 2014 where you produced your first ARM64 server. So I think just to level set, I mean, you know, what you guys really do is you, at a whole, you're a storage company leveraging Ceph So we'll talk a little bit about Ceph and how that fits in a little bit later on, software defined. But you design, you know, design the firmware. It's all in-house in California. So talk a little bit about, you know, how you guys decided to do that, you know, and then why did you choose the ARM64 processor to sort of base your infrastructure on?
Yeah, so they're kind of parallel tracks, actually. So the personality of Softdyne is, you know, when you start to do something as ambitious as we plan to do in data center servers and appliances, you're obviously very small. And the industry today survives on the basis of volume. So everyone extracts margin at volume. And they produce generic computers. The manufacturing is done largely in Asia. And, you know, it's pretty just well understood that volume is critical to everything. So when we set out to design this sort of next generation platform that would do compute and networking and storage all on one tech platform, we struggled actually to get people to work with us, because without volume, you know, no one's really interested in licensing things to you. And so we ended up doing the design of our own motherboards, the design of our own firmware to boot the processors, and our own UEFI and BIOS and et cetera. Just because, you know, we were so small, the industry doesn't really have a way of interfacing with a company that tiny. And so we kind of crawled underneath the radar more or less in stealth. And in our early chapter, we had a lot of historical experience, myself and others, around, you know, the very first ARM processors out of the UK. And so when we saw the announcement of ARM64 silicon, you know, real intent from ARM, we said, hey, there's probably going to be an ecosystem player here that is maybe good for a startup to do everything from mechanical productization to designing motherboards to software ecosystem things. And so we actually developed some of the first reference designs for ARM64 servers. We made the first production ARM64 server. We worked for all of the silicon guys. We worked for AMD very closely,
yep,
distributing their reference system. We did software work for the silicon providers and actually for ARM themselves. So we were very involved in the very early part of the ARM64 journey. And that was great for us because we got to get our feet wet. And the opportunity that we saw was ARM64, it doesn't solve all the problems. Some of our products use x86 and some of them use ARM64, which just kind of proves we're agnostic.
Yep.
What ARM64 turned out to be incredibly good at is kind of around spinning media or slight hybrid of spinning media and flash. We managed to take ARM64 and turn it into essentially a data pump. So a big DMA engine that was really focused not on processing, but on IO.
Okay.
And that turns out to be a fantastic match for software-defined storage when the rest of the world is, you know, in order to get performance and throughput on all of the different I/O paths for drives and for network, you need to buy a very hefty processor. So you end up with a lot of fat, a lot of heat, a lot of power, and they're all problems for storage.
That's interesting, actually, because, you know, my background previous to this designing, you know, hosting platforms, looking at storage was always the biggest headache for us. You know, you take a punt every time you look at a new player in town. Do you just go with the traditional guys because that's the safest option? But you're right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, when you think about what a traditional sort of, say, EMC array looked like, big, hefty, look about NetApps, big, hefty, lots of power consumption, lots of racks. It was just, they're just bulky. You just expect that, right? You expect to kind of go down the path of that. And like you said, that's the expectation. If you want to get more performance, more IOPS out of these platforms, you need to basically, you know, deal with the fact that you are going to have these big, bulky systems. And to that point as well, I think a lot of what I've seen over the, since, you know, the EMC days and the bigger days, the new guys that came on the scene probably, you know, now talking 10 years ago now, really looked at super micro type servers. So that commodity type of server to basically build their systems on. So you guys are different to that as well, aren't you? Is that you kind of took a unique approach to just taking an off the shelf commodity product, putting some software on, putting your own operating system on and kind of repackaging that. You've decided to control the process end to end, which I think, you know, is starting to reap benefits.
Oh yeah, big time. Really, you know, we're sort of obsessive about how we extract results, and really the art of the possible is what drives us. So I mentioned at the beginning, there's a lot of fat in existing systems, and that's just because there's a lot of processing that, you know, ironically for software-defined storage, you really need to focus more about IO paths and how you do DMA and you have a data pump for things going from network to drives and back again, rather than, you know, just processing for its own sake. I mean, you need enough and you never want to be short, but there's, you know, the kind of Goldilocks zone of how much processing and how you balance the appliance. And so if you look at what makes an amazing software-defined storage product and what makes a good computer, those two things are often orthogonal. And so when you drive down and you really, you know, we design all of our own electronics, you know, in-house, we root our own PCBs, we manufacture everything. It's bordering on a mental disorder at some point, but we're very proud of the results we get. So, you know, I'll give you some examples of things that we can do. So, you know, typically you take a, you know, an industry box, you mentioned Supermicro, that can often be, you know, half a kilowatt, for example. It's meant to do compute, you plug drives in, you put software on top and you pretend it's a storage device, right? And it's, you know, that instance would be software compatible. It's one of the things that we are also kind of pretty strong on is just leaving the open source unadulterated so that customers' data is really free. They own it. They could use, you know, mixed clusters or move away from Softiron if we don't perform or do our job right, which, you know, never happens. But the results are really what counts. You know, one of the things that we get to is huge amounts of density because we don't have a full computer in there in the sense of a server. So we pack things pretty tightly. We don't generate really any power on the processor relative to a normal computer. And so we can reverse the airflow so that we cool the drives. A funny little fact is that, you know, by reducing the temperature of the drives by about 25 degrees C, you double the reliability. Just
wow. Yeah. It makes sense, right?
Because of heat, right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of not obvious. It's a second order realization that, hey, you know, we get this reliability because we use less power. We're typically, you know, one fifth of the power of something that is more traditional looking. That makes a huge difference. Often we have customers that they essentially rent thin air. They get a rack and by the time they've plugged in, you know, a dozen boxes or so, they maybe have power limits per rack. And so we never end up in that situation. We're going to always fill the rack. You know, we do things around data distribution and cable removal, which gives you a quality and reliability and also often a performance increase. We have in our boxes a way of being agnostic around what the media is, you know, be it NVMe at one end and spinning media at another, a mix of it, how we mix it. We put those drives into a collection of arrangements, which we put in a caddy, essentially, that plugs into a very, very high-speed backplane in the box. So there are just no cables. So that allows us to do a whole bunch of integration into Ceph. We have a thing affectionately called the Ceph button that we press on the caddy to tell the whole self cluster, but also the individual box, hey, we're going to remove this collection of drives right now. It has a little power supply in there and it allows you to find the drives and locate them and locate which caddy you need to take out. And then when you reintroduce it, everything happens gracefully, which is distinctly different than what happens if you just take a computer and you go trying to look at which drive represents which device driver, et cetera, in Linux. It's a mess. So we just try and do things that, you know, everything from it being toolless, it being one U, a single man lift. We try to think about everything about, you know, from remote hands to how you do management and how you do legacy integration as well. So there's a whole ecosystem that we're sort of obsessive around in terms of user experience, performance, heat, and just general quality. And so what we're trying to do is take the standard of, you know, Ceph as a software-defined storage stack and then work out, if you go from a source code level, what is the absolute best experience you can have around the whole 360 of the product, and then continue to sort of push down product innovation so that, you know, people can have a more traditional enterprise match in storage experience, but they have all the freedom and all the kind of modern expression around software-defined storage. And that's a mix that customers seem to really love, that you advocate for their freedom and you advocate for an enterprise level of integration, and then stand behind it with a product that they get all of these instant benefits of, you know, power, performance, et cetera. So,
yeah, that's great. And I think what I'll do in the show notes, because I watched a couple of videos of your fabrication, you know, the way that you guys put it all together, it's actually quite cool to see, right? And again, it's something that you wouldn't expect. I certainly didn't expect it before I started to research that, you know, you guys are doing all that. So it's definitely something that sets you apart. And I think it's quite a cool thing, but it's got a reason. It's not just doing it for the hell of it. You're doing it for a particular outcome. So I think that's part of, you know, the fact that you're doing, taking the hardware, putting some great technology, some great software on that, and driving it towards that outcome. So I just wanted to spend just a couple more minutes on the history, because I was just looking through, you know, your timeline, and, you know, your first product was called, was it Overdrive, which I'm guessing was your first sort of product to market. And then that was about 2015. And then, you know, through 2015, 17, you got your first funding round. So there was a $7 million initial funding round, which was bettered by $34 million in March 2020. And then, you know, rushing through that, I want to get to the Hyperdrive because, you know, number one, who doesn't like a Hyperdrive? But number two, just to sort of maybe get your sort of take on those 4 years as you went from your first product, got some funding, and then, you know, to where you are effectively today, which is, you know, with the Hyperdrive and where that sits today and the success that you've had. And, you know, you've expanded to different countries. You established in 2019, you had an R&D center in Prague, or in Czech Republic, I think. Brno? Whereabouts was that in Prague?
In Brno.
Brno, yeah,
Brno, okay. Czech Republic.
Secondary city, yeah. Prague's one of my favorite cities around the world. I want to get back there soon. But yeah, so you established there. And then more recently, you've kind of, you know, set up, you know, I guess operations around APJ, New Zealand, Australia. So you're really sort of spreading around the globe as well. But yeah, talk about the first product, the funding, and then Hyperdrive, which will lead us into the final things I want to talk about, which is around Ceph and how that all fits in into the ecosystem and the open source aspect of it.
Yeah, so the first product we made was around this ARM64, you know, kind of ecosystem and building that out. And then the realization that that leads to an ability to make just an amazing software-defined storage product, particularly around spinning media. Obviously, we use x86 at the very high end. That's, you know, we have a crossover point. But we had this realization, and then we started to do some experiments and flesh out what we could actually achieve. And so Overdrive was really just ARM64 servers, and a lot of people use them in the ecosystem for developing the Linux kernel, developing lots of ARM64 stuff. So those Overdrive boxes, they found themselves in all sorts of crazy places, you know, cloud providers, classified environments, you know, the normal ARM integrators, et cetera. And then we produced, you know, a kind of initial storage product, and it's just, you know, essentially one product at the time. And then what that's grown into after raising our initial funding is two things, one very, very strategic thing, and then also a product portfolio. So what we realized is that we could build one technology platform that would eventually do storage, networking, compute, and acceleration with a high-speed backplane and just this totally new way of doing things. And so we built that technical platform, and it took us many, many years. I mean, just getting the high-speed backplane to 6 terabits per second in a one new box over kind of 30 inches of distance, it took us a few years. You know, it's really complicated physics. And so everything in there is about this technology platform. So we developed our own, you know, BMC. We developed all of the firmware that was a dependency for, you know, motherboards of different kinds. We developed various different kinds of networking assets. So that was one very strategic floor plan, if you like, of one set of mechanical engineering, one backplane, one caddy system. And so everything is uniform. We can build a whole bunch of products. And the original goal was to build something that was so technology agnostic, we could put things together like storage Lego or beyond storage, other kinds of technical Lego in the data center, and get these amazing results that I'm talking about. And so within that technology framework, within that platform, we can take everything from spinning media to pure NVMe and go from, you know, being successful replacing tape with spinning media to things that, you know, are 200 gigabits per second wire speed off a 1RU okay. box and aggregate up to terabits per second of workloads like S3, for example.
Yeah. So you're talking about basically offering, you know, a solution that can cover a gamut of workloads, whether it be high density archival to, you know, high performance storage as well.
That's exactly it. And just do it with one technology. So there are some benefits to that. One is kind of DevOps and SecOps and consistency. Another one is that because we control all aspects of the ecosystem, we can do things on a cluster scale, like upgrades and installs and, you know, various other things that you just couldn't do normally if you had a split between hardware and software. We obviously develop all of the software, including the low-level firmware that runs on SoCs and things like that, our own BMC. And so we have this very unusual property, which we got told by the DoD a little while ago now, that we're the only computer company in the world that has a way to expose all of the mechanism of what's running on the chip, in the software, in the boot domain, in the UEFI, in the OS. We can demonstrate all the source, and we can also show all of the circuit diagrams and integration as far as design also manufacture. So we have this
not like hiding anything.
So you could literally come to Softdyne and audit our products for mechanism, just like you would audit financials, except it's more detailed. And so
which is so important in this day and age, right? When there's such a sort of focus on security. There's an element of untrust in this industry at the moment. It's perpetuating because of, you know, supply chain attacks, that sort of thing. So to be able to offer that and have that, you know, especially from DoD, which is significant, that's a big plus for you guys as well.
Yeah, no, it's where people appreciate it, they really appreciate it. And the width of the number of people starting to appreciate it more since ransomware attacks and a bunch of hardware vector attacks that aren't really in the news cycle, I think it's becoming evident that is a real threat. And some people care, some people don't care, but when they care, they tend to really care.
Yeah, they typically care after the fact, don't they? Which is sometimes too sometimes too late. Let's kind of segue to the discussion as to the why of the company as well, and what makes you guys unique in terms of, yeah, you mentioned software-defined storage, and that's a throwaway term for the most today. I know that in my experience is dealing with different vendors over the years, they will claim that they are software defined. They'll claim that they're highly scalable at the back end. You know, it's exponential scalability or linear scalability. But obviously, you know, the problem that I've always run into traditionally, and again, I've been kind of out of the game for 5 years in terms of having to put something and do something in anger. But the biggest thing that we ran into, and I still hear it today, is that a lot of companies promise scale, but effectively there's still some sort of bottleneck along the way. So to be truly software defined is to truly have that scale out. But maybe talk about software defined and what it means to you guys and how you guys are, you know, perpetuating SDS in the correct way.
Yeah, that's a really cool question and one close to my heart, because I think that if you look at software defined storage and you look at traditional storage, you know, kind of scale up kind of storage in particular, people look at how you protect data, how you have resilience, how you have high uptime, and how you get performance. There's a series of pipes at some level. You know, you have the big fat pipes, you go to the medium pipes, you go to the skinny pipes, and that's how you assess performance. And there are some things about software-defined storage that are very subtle. And I have to admit, embarrassingly, it took me many, many years to kind of work these things out. And some of those examples are that you often, I think it's hard for some people to understand that you can really rely on the software to be designed knowing that things are going to fail or things are going to be removed. And so, for example, there's debates about how many power supplies. You know, the industry norm is two networks and two power supplies often. SDS presents an option that you don't really need that. You could just remove a whole node and it's meant to survive that.
Yes.
And that expression in software is often, I think, seen with suspicion, but it's actually an opportunity for simplicity, or, you know, it's an option and options are good. There are subtleties that took me a while to discover, which is that, for example, as you grow out a true software-defined storage cluster, as it gets bigger, the percentage blast radius of one drive or one node going away is usually reduced. So as you scale it out horizontally, you insulate yourself from failure and you provide hopefully better kind of performance and,
yes,
and uptime. And as you do that, particularly in a real software-defined storage system like Ceph, you generally linearly increase performance. And your ability to do that goes on a long, long, long way. It's really limited by network and nodes and physical space. And you know, your ability to scale a true software-defined storage stack is also, practically speaking, unlimited. It's just absolutely massive. And so the thing about Ceph and the thing that attracted us to Ceph is that the juicy center of how Ceph works, like a primordial atomic kind of object, everything is an object in Ceph, the way it stores it, it's incredibly consistent. And that mechanism has lots of knobs and dials, but you can express policy outside of that and you can do things very consistently. And so when you go bottom up like that, you have this ability not only to scale, not only to increase performance, not only to do the same thing and consistently do it, which is great for us because we concentrate on doing that bottom level very, very well. But you can surround it with other things and use it for other things as you need to. So, you know, in real software-defined storage stacks like Ceph, you can do block, you can do object, and you can, yep, do file. And all of these properties are preserved. As you continue to do more and more, it works consistently the same way. Certain configuration items like authentication work the same way. When you want to do workloads like S3, you consume that S3, you know, directly from that kind of pool and present it through gateways, and they scale and load balance and do all the natural things. So it's this kind of software system that looks like an onion. It has this perfectly correct center, and then everything is built around it until eventually you touch things like legacy, you know, things like SMB or iSCSI or other things. And so what I really like about Ceph in particular is that when it's done right, and I would argue, you know, kind of the best hardware you can get, for example, the kind of integrations with legacy around protocol attach, which is an area we really focus on productizing, and you put together, you know, kind of enterprise class management to make it consumable by mere mortals, it makes something that is kind of a CIO's dream, because every account that I ever touch, every customer they ever see, they have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, yeah, and a little bit of another thing, and then they have a generational switch. And you know, today CIOs are asked to do more and more and more every year with less and less and less. It's kind of the IT story, right? And so this idea of one technology, the huge amount of leverage you get, these percentage increases of either performance or decreases of blast radius, the idea that you have one fleet that all consistently looks the same, and frankly, you have staff that really only need to know how to be good at one thing, which is software-defined storage.
Yeah. I was going to say, you've talked about, and you've really hit the nail on the head in terms of where I historically saw Ceph. First trying to kind of get it up and running from an S3 perspective years ago now, back in my previous role. And, you know, the challenge for us, and I think for a lot of kind of platform storage provider types out there, was that, do we look at something and go open source and do something that's like Ceph, or do we go and just get something that's off the shelf and more expensive? And there was always the trade-off of, you know, Ceph seems decent, but we're going to have to hire someone to basically run Ceph and keep Ceph going, versus taking something from like Dell or whatever it might be, and effectively, you know, let them handle that side of it. So traditionally, Ceph has been challenging if people attack it themselves. And I think even still now, I still run into people that are, you know, in the service provider space that are running Ceph natively. And they still run into all sorts of issues. There's still lots of bells, lots of tweaks to basically get right. So I feel like that's what you guys are almost hitting the easy button. And you mentioned that Ceph button before. And again, looking through the UI and seeing how that kind of lays its thing, the configuration, the fact that you can see every node, you can see every disk, all the sort of bits that are happening within that Ceph cluster, and then you present it via all the protocols that you mentioned, S3 being one of the leading ones through the gateway. You fundamentally solved, I personally think you fundamentally solved the problem with Ceph. So you guys have leveraged it, you've taken it, you've wrapped it up and done something that solves that problem. Is that a fair statement, or am I kind of selling Ceph a little bit short there?
I think Ceph's come a very, very long way from the early days. I mean, we're starting to see Ceph, for example, we try to really push performance for Ceph, and we're seeing, you know, terabit per second kind of workload across a whole cluster, multiple hundreds of gigabits per second of wire speed throughput per box, per one RU. So really up there. And we're seeing it really touch other file systems like Lustre, for example. In a national lab, we have a customer that literally just tested our Ceph against Lustre and found out that it really gives Lustre a run for its money. So it's finding its way into the places that traditionally it's not perceived as kind of acting in. And then what we've been doing along two vectors in Softdyn is giving customers a kind of true enterprise support experience, not an open source support experience.
Yeah, so that's a big
a collection of not just file a ticket and then let it wander through, you know, kind of anonymity until eventually, you know, the problem gets solved some way. We really hold the customer's hand in the sort of enterprise class of support. And that's the thing that our customers I know really support. And then back that with, you know, kind of tribal knowledge of all of the Ceph knowledge. I mean, we're a company that doesn't do Ceph along with a bunch of other things inside a Linux distro. We actually do Ceph full-time for a living. It's sort of what we do. So there's a lot of tribal knowledge in there. And then as we've met customers and we've listened to customers and we've looked at what open source is good at and what, you know, when you turn a corner, often something will break. We've tried to really listen with discipline to customers and hear what they really want as a management interface. And so that's how we've productized it, is to meet the customers on their own terms, as opposed to present Ceph with all the bells and whistles with a clicky GUI experience as opposed to a command line. And that's, we heard time and time again, we don't want that. We want these things and we want to do these activities. And this is the way we want to consume it. And don't make me bend to Ceph. Let me consume my storage and solve a storage problem.
Yeah, and just looking at your tech specs, you know, you build and price. You got so many options there in terms of where they can start, the performance options, the high density options. Then you got the gateways and whatnot, and those management plans as well. So it's really like, you know, customers can come and kind of choose their own what the purpose built sort of situation, and then they get the benefits like you just said. In terms of just Ceph and finishing off there, just before we wrap up, the Ceph Foundation, you guys, and this is sort of spun out from the Linux Foundation, but maybe just talk a little bit about that, how I'm guessing that's a mechanism just to support the open source side of Ceph. Maybe just talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, we were cheerleaders. We were there in the beginning. We're still on the Ceph board. We're trying to push various other commercial vectors of, you know, kind of exploring the development of Ceph, et cetera. So, you know, we're big cheerleaders. I think that the Ceph Foundation really is an indication of the fact that Ceph has come such a long way. You know, it was Ink Tank and then it was a Red Hat sport followed by some others. And now it really has kind of found its own feet. It's got its own foundation. It's very much, you know, kind of, I think it's just a sign of maturity, really. And so there are new working groups inside the Ceph Foundation, investigating all sorts of different things, like how we describe Ceph, how we advocate for Ceph, et cetera. So, it's come an awful long way, and particularly the last 3 years, it's just amazing.
Good stuff. No, that's good. Good to hear. And maybe I just want to finish off with a couple of questions. And I think you guys, you've talked about the value that soft iron adds and what it offers. I think from what I can see as well, it offers, super sort of controllable, flexible scale out storage that covers multiple workloads. I see an absolute sort of pivotal use case for S3 in this sense, because I think that's where the industry is going. Object store, obviously Ceph being object based, but they're not S3 gateways at the top, and being able to consume that in a true scale out fashion is significant. But how did you feel that you disrupted the market initially? What was the one thing that kind of said, yeah, okay, soft iron are here, they've arrived?
Oh, we're sort of a different kind of a company around software-defined storage in general. I mean, it's mostly everything that we do is around software-defined storage and stuff. We're a company dedicated to doing that. We make an appliance that is dedicated to doing that. So there's an obsessive gene here about doing the best we possibly can. And I think what we do that no one really does the same way is, obviously, we push the quality and the security vector. We use manufacturing as a weapon of war to get those results. We get this power reduction, reliability, wire speed performance, all the way up, the whole product portfolio by using storage Lego to put different pieces in place for customers at the right price point, performance point. And we just try to surround Ceph as an open source representation of SDS, but also data freedom for the customers, that they're really not locked into a vendor. And then they're not going to get the same level of performance or quality by using generic hardware and putting just generic software on top. But they're fundamentally free to go and use other hardware and other software. We don't lock them in. So yeah, we try and deliver freedom, which is the modern world, right? We live in an open source enterprise at this point.
I love the fact say that you don't lock them in, right? Because that's always been one of the biggest issues with storage, is that you just feel absolutely locked in. That next maintenance renewal, you're locked in, right? So I love the fact that you guys openly say that. And that to me says that you guys trust what you do, because you trust your customer to effectively, here's the option, but let's just stick with them moving forward, So I think that's a very big feather in your caps.
We've never lost a customer, and I'm very proud of that. It's really one-way traffic as far as product.
That's
it
awesome.
It leaves the building, it doesn't come back for quality reasons, and it doesn't come back for customer reasons. So, we try really hard. We're really dedicated to doing this right. And, I think it's a very interesting mixture of tribal knowledge, really caring about meeting the customer on enterprise terms, but delivering something that is true open source without lock-in, and then doing it in a performant quality way. And I think that's what customers really want. I mean, they tell us this in so many different ways, that this is actually what we really want in storage, is the ability to use software-defined storage so we get all of these leverage points and the economy and the freedom. But we kind of want it in the old-fashioned stodgy enterprise way, where we have someone who's, who cares on the end of the phone. And then we get a good product underneath. So
good stuff.
All right.
Last question. So now that you've disrupted, how are you going to continually internally disrupt yourselves and then obviously continue innovation?
So at the beginning, I mentioned that we built this technical platform and it could do more than storage. And so there's a clue. Mm-hmm. You can see transcoders on our website. You can see top of rack switches on our website.
I can, yeah.
And you can see a market movement of, people realizing that public clouds are absolutely awesome. You can buy an outcome. They operate them very well. You have physical disposition in lots of different countries and locations. It's very scalable. You kind of buy it and then throw it away. It's kind of disposable at some level, maybe. So public clouds are great, but I think a lot of people are realizing that you maybe need a balance, and it's not just enterprise or cloud. We have probably a hybrid environment that is going to become the norm. And when you look at hybrid, there are a couple of things that happen as soon as you say that. First of all, you have your own fleet. You probably care about the hardware. You probably split sometimes because of security. And so this idea of provenance and being able to audit your hardware and have security properties may be even more important. And then have something that is software defined by definition in the storage and data environment so that you can integrate with public clouds elegantly. And so, I'll kind of tip my hat just that far and say, if you imagine that we have a technical platform and we solved all of these hard storage problems, networking is the thing that ties it all together, and compute is actually just this disposable thing that you connect to the data. And if you start with hybrid, you have to care about hardware, you have to care about the edge, and that's really what we've been building.
Good stuff. Good to hear. I'm looking forward to seeing what is to come for Softiron over the next couple of years. It's really exciting. And, you know, you guys have set yourself up, 10 years old next year and getting stronger. So with that, let's wrap up with the show notes. Again, I'll put a list of notes in regards to, you know, having the manufacturing and the products of Softiron, and we can go from there. You can find me at Anthony Spiteri on Twitter and at GTWGT Podcast, or you can go to gtwgt.com. And just a final reminder, if you aren't subscribed or new to the show, you can subscribe to us on the podcast client or catch up via the web or on LinkedIn these days as well, via the Great Things with Great Tech LinkedIn page. So with that, I'd like to thank Phil and Softiron, and we will catch you next time on Great Things with Great Tech. Cool. All righty.